waiting for a 2-year-old birthday party for the police to come over. I guess they were really loud, huh? VOA1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Alice Bryant. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
Egypt is experiencing a renewed social media movement against sexual abuse that led to many accusations against a single man. Cairo police arrested 21-year-old Ahmed Bassam Zaki at his home 10 days ago. The case has captured the country's attention, partly because those involved come from rich and powerful families. Women's rights activists say they hope the government's quick action signals a change in how the country deals with accusations of sexual wrongdoing. More than 100 girls and women describe meeting Zaki in person and online. Their individual accusations include rape, assault, and blackmail. Some of the accusers were children when the reported crimes took place. Activists say the case shows that sex abuse is widespread in the country. Many in Egypt had argued in the past that only poor and uneducated people carried out sex crimes. "What's before this case is totally different from what's after," said Nihad Abul Kamsen. She is head of the Egyptian Center for Women's Rights and a lawyer representing some of the reported victims. Sexual wrongdoing is a complex problem in Egypt. The country's conservative culture ties female sexual innocence to a family's social image. In courts, the responsibility of proof lies heavily on the victims of such crimes. In a statement, the public prosecutor's office said the accused man admitted to blackmailing at least 6 girls. He reportedly threatened to send sensitive images of them to their families if the girls cut off contact with him. Several attempts by the Associated Press to contact Zaki or his lawyer were unsuccessful. Amira Deeb, Egypt's popular television show host, reported on the case recently. He said he had talked with Zaki's father, a high-level official at a telecommunications company. The man reportedly said that his son dismissed the accusations. Abu Kamsen says at least 10 women have filed official reports with the police. Activists created an Instagram account, @AssaultPolice, to gather accusations, said Saba Kodir, a United States-based writer who helps run the account. She said there are more than 100 reports so far. "We are demanding to be listened to. We are just using what we have, lending our voices to hopefully create some kind of change," she said. A court has ordered that Zaki remain in jail while an investigation continues. The prosecutor has urged any other possible victims to make official reports. Last week, Egypt's government proposed a measure to increase protections of the identities of victims of sexual wrongdoing. Parliament is to consider the proposal. If approved, it will be sent to President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who can approve or reject the measure. The charges against Zaki cover suspected crimes carried out over at least 3 years. Many of the accusations on social media appear to be from students at the American International School, one of the country's costliest private high schools. Many others appear to be students at American University in Cairo. Zaki went to both schools. University officials said Zaki left the school in 2018. He apparently was admitted to the European Union Business School in Spain in an online program last year. In February, he traveled to Barcelona to study at EUBS on site. 3 weeks later, school officials suspended and later expelled him after learning of accusations against him, including some by students at the school. EUBS has since filed a criminal report in cooperation with At Assault Police to demand Spanish police fully investigate Zaki's reported actions. The head of the American University in Cairo, Francis Ricciardoni, said university policy treats sexual abuse of any kind as unacceptable. However, he said he would not comment on an ongoing case. The recent reports against Zaki led Egypt's Al-Azhar, the Sunni Muslim world's top religious center, to speak out about sexual crimes. I'm Katie Weaver.
When several students came to her office one day in 2009 with high temperatures and pain in their throats, Mary Pappas knew something was wrong. So she called the New York City Health Department. That call soon led to national action in what would become the H1N1 influenza pandemic, including the closure of some schools. Lori Combe is president of the National Association of School Nurses, or NASN. She recently told VOA that while school nurses can play an important role during any public health crisis, they are always sentinels for health in the school community. Combe explained that during a health crisis, school nurses can take on an amplified role. During the coronavirus crisis, teaching children and others how to wear face coverings and wash their hands is only a small piece of their work. As the virus picked up speed and schools closed, Combe says nurses continued to do much of their usual work while taking on new responsibilities, some of which involve planning.
School nurses are highly engaged in the physical and mental health needs of students and have expertise in emergency planning for pandemics.
Many school districts are deciding whether and how to reopen for the fall term. The planning comes as some parts of the U.S. experience sharp increases in coronavirus infection rates. President Donald Trump has been pushing for schools to reopen in the fall. He recently criticized safety guidelines set by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for schools to reopen. Trump said he found the guidelines impractical and too costly. The Trump administration has threatened to withhold federal money if districts do not fully reopen. Still, even when schools remain physically closed, the need for nurses' usual expertise does not disappear. For instance, during the spring term, nurses continued many of their daily duties, such as keeping in contact with parents of children with health conditions or parents who needed medical advice and resources. Some nurses even took medicines and equipment to homes of students with health conditions. When schools shut their doors, some students received no home instruction. So, some nurses reached out to families and students to find out if their needs were being met. Aside from physical or mental health concerns, nurses found that many students lacked access to the internet. The need for meals continued too, so nurses helped oversee the safe processes for delivering food to students, Combs said. Around 30 million American children depend on low-cost or free school meals each day for nutrition, the U.S. Department of Agriculture reports. As schools remained closed, nurses stayed connected through local and national groups to stay informed about the virus. They also turned to state and federal health agencies for expert guidance. Janice Hogan is a nurse at Camden Hills Regional High School in Rockport, Maine. When schools in her state closed in the spring, she continued to perform some day-to-day responsibilities. But she also began taking part in video meetings with school nurses from around the country. And Hogan joined an international online group of mostly school nurses to learn what was happening in Europe's reopened schools.
So in some ways, it was an amazing time of connection for school nurses because we were all in the same boat, but our boats were all a little bit different.
Hogan is also on a team considering the state's plans to reopen schools. Maine, which has had comparably low coronavirus infection rates, recently released its first reopening proposal. School nurses are named throughout the plan as central to the team effort, which includes administrators, teachers, transportation workers, food service, and others. Nurses nationally have been involved in these cooperative efforts. But not all schools have their own school nurse. U.S. school districts began cutting nurse staff leading up to the Great Recession of the early 2000s. Most districts did not bring the nurses back. Instead, many that were able to keep their jobs now work part-time at several different schools. A 2016 study by NASN showed that just 39% of U.S. schools employ a full-time nurse. And 25% of public schools had no nurse at all. About 35% have a part-time nurse. The American Academy of Pediatrics, or AAP, an organization of children's doctors, urges that all schools have at least one full-time nurse, A few years ago, the AAP said it would be best to have at least one nurse for every 750 students. But even now, as the coronavirus crisis continues, many U.S. school districts have just one nurse for well over 1,000 students. Hogan said the shortage is especially troubling because many children receive their main or only medical attention from school nurses. Not much has changed since the earlier U.S. pandemics. A report by the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, on the 1918 influenza pandemic stated that officials in some cities, such as New York City and New Haven, Connecticut, chose to keep public schools open. Officials reasoned that many children would have little or no medical supervision if schools closed. They also argued that schools could be more effectively disinfected than homes. In those cities, school nurses and doctors performed daily medical inspections at schools. The nurses also educated their school communities on virus prevention, and some made home visits to inspect the health of students and families. While much has changed since the early 20th century, the need for health experts at schools during a pandemic has not. With large drops in tax revenues caused by the coronavirus pandemic, schools across the U.S. have experienced huge budget cuts. Combe finds this concerning. She said that she has already heard reports of some nursing cuts, although massive reductions have not yet happened. Combe added that some schools are looking to bring in more nurses to help with the expected workload to come. If schools reopen, there are also worries about getting necessary supplies. In the Houston, Texas area, for example, the state education agency is providing schools some personal protective equipment, or PPE. But the equipment does not include high-quality N95 face masks.
School health rooms historically have very small budgets, maybe 10, 20, 30 cents per student for a whole school year.
A congressional bill called the Nurse Act, launched in March 2018, intended to increase school nurses in underfunded schools. The bill, however, did not pass. I'm Alice Bryant.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact the doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Chester A. Arthur. The letter A is for Alan, his middle name. Arthur took office because of an unexpected event. He was sworn in as Vice President in March 1881 under James Garfield. But only 100 days into Garfield's term, the president was shot. He suffered for months. Arthur was not close to Garfield. The two men belonged to the same party, but they had different ideas on the issues of the day. They publicly disagreed on a number of subjects. If Garfield lived, Arthur would probably not have much power in his administration. But Garfield eventually died. By this time, it was well established that if the President of the United States dies in office, the Vice President becomes the President. So, in September 1881, Arthur became the country's chief executive. He served the remaining 3.5 years of Garfield's term. Historians say that, for the most part, Arthur performed ably and well. Chester Arthur was raised in the northeastern states of Vermont and New York. He was one of 8 children in his family. Their father was a religious leader and anti-slavery activist. Arthur attended college in New York, then taught school and studied law. But he never wanted to stay in a small town and live modestly. He wanted to live in New York City, work as a lawyer and public official, become wealthy, and enjoy the lifestyle of a gentleman. And that is what he did. Arthur advanced from an entry-level job in a law office to a leadership position in the military during the Civil War. After the fighting stopped, he worked in a good-paying job as a lawyer, and then accepted a top position in the government. For 7 years, Arthur served as the collector of the Port of New York. His job involved supervising 1,300 people. They collected large amounts of money that came from taxes on imported goods. The job had a political element, too. It was under the control of a U.S. senator from New York, Roscoe Conkling. Conkling was known as a Republican Party chief who traded political support for financial and other benefits. Arthur was never found guilty of accepting money or gifts in exchange for the help of his office, but he was closely linked to Conkling's political machine. When Rutherford B. Hayes became president in 1878, he tried to fight corruption in government jobs. He targeted Conkling and Arthur. Arthur's position as the collector of the Port of New York was one of the issues in the election of 1880. President Hayes had suspended Arthur from the job. To get it back, Arthur and Conkling supported an effort to re-elect former president Ulysses S. Grant. But another candidate won the Republican Party's presidential nomination, James Garfield. Garfield and Arthur were not natural allies. Although they were both Republicans, they represented different points of view. Political leaders hoped to unite the party. So when Garfield was chosen as the presidential candidate, they added Arthur as the vice presidential nominee. The effort to unite the party worked well enough to win the election, but relations between the two men were uneasy. One of Garfield's first acts was to appoint someone for Arthur's old job in New York. The new president wanted someone who was not loyal to Conkling, so he gave the position to one of his supporters instead. In protest, Conkling resigned from the Senate. But then events took an unexpected turn. Garfield was shot by a mentally unbalanced man who believed the president owed him a government job. And Chester A. Arthur became president. When Arthur took office, he had the public image of being an experienced political operator. Most people believed he cared only about supporting the aims of a small part of the Republican Party. Instead, President Arthur took an independent position on several issues. In opposition to most of his party, Arthur supported legislation to reform the country's civil service. It aimed to clean up corruption in government and took away some of the ability of politicians to give government jobs to their supporters. To be fair, in the short term, the act helped Arthur's party. Arthur also broke with the Republican Party leadership to support a reduction in tariffs, and he strongly argued to limit spending federal money on projects that helped only a few areas or businesses. Instead, he wanted to cut taxes so more people would profit from the government's surplus. Finally, Arthur vetoed an anti-immigration act from Congress. The measure proposed banning Chinese immigrants for 20 years. Arthur argued that the Chinese had improved the American economy by helping build a railroad across the country. He also did not want to hurt potential trade with China. However, when Congress offered to ban Chinese immigrants for only 10 years, Arthur agreed. In addition, his administration banned immigrants who were considered poor, criminal, or mentally insane. Perhaps Arthur's most memorable act as president, however, was to redecorate the White House. He did not like its appearance inside, so he asked one of New York's top designers, Louis Tiffany, to make the home brighter and more stylish. In the newly remodeled rooms, Arthur held parties with fine food and drink for elite guests. He was known as the gentleman boss. Observers then and now say that Arthur served well as president. He was a solid leader after the difficult years of the Civil War and Reconstruction. But Arthur did not live much beyond his presidency. Shortly into his term, he learned he had a serious kidney disease that would likely kill him. As a result, he did not try hard to get reelected. Instead, after finishing his term, he returned to his home in New York. Arthur tried to work as a lawyer, but he soon became too sick. His wife had died of malaria before he became president, and he liked to spend his free time fishing or with friends instead of with his children. But in his last months, he could not enjoy those activities either. He died at home at the age of 57. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.